This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we broadcast our crucial recent interview with Australian journalist John Pilger.
I would say he's a great journalist, probably the best journalist in the world, and we're talking about the coming war with China. No question could be more crucial to us. Give a listen. We also speak with Andrew Perez, senior editor for The Lever, on the hypocrisy of the Democratic and Republican parties on climate change.
Andrew raises Obama's legacy on the climate crisis as just one example.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
Today, we're rebroadcasting a recent interview we did with the great Australian journalist John Pilger called The Coming War with China. With the exception of a short break at the conclusion in 1975 of the Vietnamese War, the United States has been at war continually. The momentum of what President Dwight Eisenhower warned us against and described as being led by the military-industrial complex has been going on with successive wars against Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and now the American proxy war in Ukraine. The military-industrial complex has been augmented by support from the CIA, Congress, both parties, and the corporate media. As Pilger demonstrates, the United States is building up for a war against China. This buildup is both military and ideological, and shaped by hostile propaganda. In this respect, an alarming full-page New York Times article, 11 Weeks in the Making, and written by 7 reporters, appeared on August 5th. The article targeted the American peace organization Code Pink, as well as one of its financial backers. It's a hit piece that has alarmed many of us in the movement. John Pilger gives us the background to it. Give a listen.
Today we speak with 83-year-old renowned journalist, author, and documentary filmmaker John Pilger from his home in Australia about his most recent article, The Coming War with China. Is China a threat? Is the fear that is being stirred up about China legitimate? China has the second largest economy in the world. It will soon be the first. In response to China's commercial threat, the United States has responded militarily by surrounding the Chinese industrial heartland with 400 bases in what has been called a noose. The U.S. has some 1,100 bases around the world, while China has 6. President Obama initiated a multi-trillion-dollar vast nuclear buildup. This was coordinated with what he termed a, quote, pivot towards Asia. Most of the U.S. Navy now patrols the waters off of China. Tensions have been exacerbated with respect to who governs Taiwan. The U.S. government has shored up its military alliances with China's neighboring countries, such as South Korea, Japan, the Philippines, and Australia. And the U.S. is selling billions of dollars worth of nuclear submarines to Australia. We in the U.S. live in a country whose government has been in a perpetual war the last 3/4 of a century, except with a brief interlude after its 20-year-old war in Vietnam ended in defeat. 3 million Vietnamese people died in that war. As a young reporter, John Pilger covered that war and understood that it was based on the lie that Lyndon Johnson told, falsely stating that the North Vietnamese had attacked an American ship in the Gulf of Tonkin. Another 1 million people died in the Iraq War. That war was based on the now well-known lie that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction that he was going to use against the U.S., and that he was responsible for the 9/11 attacks. A similar campaign of fear-mongering is going on now about China. The major news outlets parrot the government's fact-free line that China is our enemy. In his article, The Coming War with China, John Pilger wrote, quote, "A U.S. war against China beckons, and we have a responsibility to speak out. We know what is coming. Silence must be broken," end quote. John Pilger, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's very good to be on the program. Thank you, and looking forward to it very much.
Thank you. Well, in your recent article, The Coming War with China, you wrote with alarming passion about what is developing. Please tell us about this.
Well, I made a film about 4 or 5 years ago called that The Coming War on China. On China, by the way, because it's very much what is happening these days is provocation of China. The surrounding of the eastern seaboard of China with U.S. bases. And I investigated this, and it went into a film. And I've since been writing about it since, because the whole geopolitical atmosphere dominated by the United States is about the potential of a war with China, which, when you think about it, is absurd. China is not our enemy. It's never been our enemy. It shows no sign of being our enemy. And yet, where the United States is building up its so-called allies for a war with China, presumably it will be a very provocative war with China. In other words, an invasion of some description. I find all this quite, although I've been to China and I've seen the bases and I've seen the evidence, but I find all this almost unreal because there is, as I say, it's all unnecessary. But it's very much the main foreign policy thrust of the United States. Russia, I suppose, is number two, but certainly China is number one. And down here in Australia, which is an American vassal, they used to call it a 51st state, but I don't think it really has that authority these days. It does what it's told. We have many U.S. bases, and the U.S. and Australia and the United Kingdom are about to conclude a big anti-China deal, which will involve nuclear submarines. And in other words, more provocation of a country that is our greatest trading partner. That's the strange irony in all of this. The greatest trading partner of many countries, because that's what basically China is interested in trade, making things and making money, ironically.
John Pilger, please talk about how fear-mongering was used to rally the American people's support for wars in Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Ukraine, and now China.
Fear-mongering. Yeah, but even that, you see, how could the United States be frightened of the world's poorest country, Afghanistan? I think it's worth asking these questions. The Vietnam thing was based again on China, that Vietnam would be one of the communist dominoes that would fall, said the propaganda at the time, allowing the great yellow peril of China to sweep down and take over Asia. Well, that's Asia. I mean, the United States is still a long way from Asia. The United States, I don't think it cares about whether the American population has been subjected to any fear-mongering. I think it just goes ahead, and it has since 1945, and takes over governments, attacks countries, destroys democracies, vulnerable democracies. It was doing that in Latin America for a very long time, and then after the Second World War, that policy became a world policy. From the time of the Korean War on, the Vietnam War was part of that, and the fear was that communism would take over the world. Well, communism didn't take over the world, and many of the communist countries are no longer communist countries. So none of it makes sense, and I think that's very important, that in 2023 we're looking at something that should be seen from the perspective of today. And I said I used that word absurd because seen from a distance, it is absurd. Many in the world, particularly in what used to be called the third world, that is the global south, whatever you wish to call it, are waking up to that. But all this is, in my lifetime, has been about the United States dominating world affairs. That's over. And that's what we're witnessing. It's not only over, it's over disastrously. They were driven out of Afghanistan, driven out of Vietnam, and other countries have asserted themselves. That's how the world is changing. It's a very dramatic change today. It's a change of, I think it's a change of attitude as much as anything.
Mm-hmm. And if I can interject for a moment, I know that throughout your career, you've been very outspoken and believe that we all have a duty to speak out against wars, and especially like the ones that we're seeing. As far as Iraq, what do you think would have been the likely results if in Iraq more journalists and cultural figures had spoken out against the war before it started?
The media has always been an extension of the established order. There may be a lot of myths about pre-media and constitutional rights and all that stuff. But when it comes down to it, the media is owned by big conglomerates whose politics are decidedly conservative, reactionary. So the media, I think that's important, because even these days people are still asking the question, why doesn't the media do something? Well, they should stop asking the question and look at the media for what it is. Now, there are exceptions, as I say, to this. Some journalists have asked questions, and those who ask questions today pay a price. I can think of two. One is the great American investigative journalist Seymour Hersh, who has difficulty publishing his work anywhere now in the United States and has to self-publish. And of course, the second is Julian Assange. Julian Assange has spent the last 4 years in Belmarsh prison and waiting extradition on concocted charges in the United States, basically to shut him up, to close down WikiLeaks, which did a job of journalism. Both those journalists were warning the public. They were doing a basic job of journalism. They were warning the public of what they had found out, what they had investigated and found out. So in other words, these days it's very dangerous to go against power in the United States as it seeks to restore its position, its dominance.
John Pilger, talk about Obama, please. The, quote, pivot towards Asia that he announced and the nuclear buildup that he initiated. Does he deserve the adulation he still gets? Isn't it ironic that he won the Nobel Peace Prize?
You've almost got everything in Obama, because you've got the power of public relations. Obama was unique in that he was the first black president in the land of slavery. Right, once you've said that, that's the end of his uniqueness, because from that point on, he's the same and probably marginally worse than any other modern president. Obama was the great warmonger. He left office having with something like 7 wars, most of them in the Middle East, on the go. He was even given the Nobel Peace Prize. And I remember in 2009, Obama stood in the center of Prague in Czechoslovakia and made a very emotional speech of make the world nuclear free. But and just as he was speaking, his administration was planning the greatest production of nuclear warheads under any president. So if you want hypocrisy, if you want the reverse of the truth, if you want the truth behind the facade of what I would call PR, propaganda, then you go to Obama under politics. He is perfection in that, because almost everything he appeared to be, he wasn't.
Well, let's talk also about China again. I did have a question about the Belt and Road Initiative. What is the Belt and Road Initiative? What does China hope to gain by this?
The Belt and Road Initiative is basically a development plan. It's a development plan of epic proportions. It is to open up Eurasia, that vast expanse behind, if you like, quote-unquote, behind China. So all the way across to Europe from China, through hundreds of countries. One of the main reasons for it, as far as the Chinese are concerned, is not to be dependent on the oceans for its trade, for its lifelines, its lifeblood. So everything can be developed and go over land. So what we've seen already is the first freight trains from Beijing to Europe, to London, to Berlin. And developing that vast expanse has meant China offering development plans to countries that were quite underdeveloped, both in their port systems and airports and their factories, their infrastructure. So it's the development of half the world. I don't know if it is half the world, but it must be something approaching that. It's an extraordinary project, and it's forging ahead with, I mentioned, railways. High-speed railways that go for several thousand miles, you know, with trains traveling at 200 and 300 miles an hour. That's already a reality. China's building of high-speed rail networks, both for the movement of people and trade, has been the greatest spending of the greatest development of railways in its history. It's one of the many important things that we hear very little about in the West. But of course, to those who want to go to war with China, the Belt and Road is seen as China developing itself into a very powerful, aggressive country. It's not like that at all. Certainly the inevitable will happen. China will be the most economically powerful country, it almost is already, that we've ever known. And that the Belt and Road is linking China with the great expanse of Eurasia and then all the way on to Europe itself. It's what the early travelers of the Silk Road travelers, the Marco Polos, explorers used to dream of. They used to call it the World Island of Eurasia. And if you look at a map of the world from the top of it, you see it's not quite as we imagined. There is this huge area between China, Russia, and Europe. And that's what's being developed now. It's the greatest development project, I understand, in history. It's about trade.
Well, Joe Biden was about to visit Australia. Why has your prime minister failed to vigorously demand that the U.S. release your friend, the great journalist Julian Assange, who has been in prison, as you mentioned?
And I think it's a long, I think, Maria, I think it's a long way. Joe Biden would get jet lag. Anybody who comes, anybody who comes from the United States to Australia, I used to report the airport here, and I used to watch movie stars come over from the United States and fall out of the aircraft absolutely comatose with jet lag. I'm not sure Joe would survive that trip. I just my own view. But no, I'm being flippant. It's not the first time a presidential trip to Australia has been cancelled. Obama was coming here three or four times before he finally made it. Australia does what it's told. It's part of the U.S. empire. It doesn't need the coercion of a U.S. president visiting. It was certainly, this one was certainly an important one because Biden was going to announce that they'd settled all their differences and that, such as they were, and that there was now a great united front against China. It was a big anti-China trip. So we've been spared that. I mean, he was going to other places too on the way back. When you go to Australia, you go to the end of the world, so you can stop over a lot of places. And from here, he was going to the island state of Papua New Guinea, which the U.S. has recently bribed to allow the Pentagon to take over many of the ports and airports in that country, again to satisfy this strategic front against China. And I think he was stopping at some of the Pacific islands on the way, that all of these have, of course, U.S. bases. So it was really the emperor coming to the vast nether regions of the world down here in the end of the Pacific, giving us the favor of his presence. But alas, we're not going to see him.
John Pilger, unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our allotted time, but before we have to let you go, I wanted to ask you, and before I ask you for your final thoughts, I wanted to ask you, because I thought it would be enlightening and helpful to our listeners, to ask you, what do you read regularly, and what do you read to keep yourself informed?
What do I read leisurely? I read fiction. John Grisham. I'm a great admirer of John Grisham. In fact, if you want a whole program on John Grisham, I could do one. I don't like a lot of introspective fiction, but I've pushed myself away from nonfiction in the last quite a few years. So it's a good question, because I think that keeps us sane, what we're reading, actually.
John Pilger, can you give us your final thoughts, please?
My final thought, did you say?
Yes.
Sounds like I'm about to expire on your program.
No.
What? I'm sorry, I didn't. You and I have had a difficulty with what was the question? Oh, it was a final thought. Okay. Look, I'm not sure I have many final thoughts, but I would think there was a wonderful Irish journalist called Claude Coben who once said, "Never believe anything until it's officially denied." That's a good thought. I don't know whether it's the final thought, but the thought that I would leave your listeners with is, be skeptical. Be skeptical, no matter what myths you've taken on board yourself, but just be skeptical when anybody in power tells you something. Democracies these days just simply don't work, because democracies go ahead and do things that are detrimental to the majority of their people. Otherwise they'd work. I think it is about speaking up and making your voice heard, making yourself heard in a democracy is the most crucial thing of all. I mean, there's a whole history of ideas of that in the United States. We've just got to start doing it.
With that, I want to thank you sincerely, John. It's been really terrific to have you on Law and Disorder, and you take it easy.
All right. Good to be on.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
This land is their land. This land ain't ours, friend. It's owned by DuPont and the Texas oil men. From denuded forests to polluted waters, this land was stole from you and me. Well, the halls of Congress, you know I'm fairly certain, are bought and paid for by Halliburton. And the mortgage loans on your broken down shacks, yeah, they've been foreclosed by Goldman Sachs. This land is their land. This land ain't ours, friend. It's owned by Wall Street and the Texas oil men. From denuded forests to polluted waters, this land was stole from you and me. Well, it's kinda crummy and it's really shoddy that the 1% owe most everybody, and the 1% of that 1%, hell, they own the 1% as well. This land is their land. This land ain't ours, friend. It's owned by Walmart and the Texas oil men. From denuded forests to polluted waters, this land was stole from you and me. The other night, folks, you know I had a nightmare. They started charging us just to breathe air. It seems Monsanto bought up the atmosphere. Didn't help I had Obamacare. This land is their land. This land ain't ours.
As the U.S. presidential election season heats up, so too does the planet. July 2023 was the Earth's hottest month on record. And as climate scientist Frederick Otto told the Associated Press recently, quote, we should not care about July because it's a record, but because it won't be a record for long. It's an indicator of how much we have changed the climate. We are living in a very different world, one that our societies are not adapted to live in very well, end quote. Indeed, millions of people are suffering at this very moment because of extreme weather, including unrelenting, deadly heat. One might expect that during election season, presidential candidates would be champing at the bit to promote their fabulous plans to save human life on Earth, or at least slow its demise, right? I mean, who else has so much influence over changing the course of history than the President of the United States? Well, on the GOP side, the presidential hopefuls have mostly ignored the climate crisis, and some even dismiss it outright as a left-wing hoax. On the Democrat side, we have Joe Biden. Now, Biden does not shy away from admitting we have a problem. He appeared for an exclusive interview on the Weather Channel last week, calling climate change the number one issue facing humanity, and that combating climate change is, quote, a core tenet of his presidency. Well, it might be a core tenet, you know, a principle and belief, but has that translated into action? When push comes to shove in the office of president, and before that in the office of vice president, has Joe Biden done everything he can to save humanity? Or is he just stating the obvious because it's what he thinks that voters want to hear? But is he really in any rush to make changes that might alienate big oil and other corporate interests? And what about when he was vice president during the Obama administration, which set the stage for the Biden presidency? Do we even remember that anymore? Our guest, Andrew Perez, not only remembers, but he has tracked and documented the forks in the road where the Obama administration could have, but chose not to, take actions that could have slowed the warming of our planet. Andrew Perez is an investigative reporter and senior editor for The Lever, which was just awarded the 2023 Izzy Award for Outstanding Achievement by Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College, for its relentless work, quote, exposing the corrupting influence of corporate power on government and both major parties, end quote. The center specifically highlighted Andrew's work for exposing the largest known political donation in U.S. history, Chicago businessman Barry Saeed's $1.6 billion money transfer to conservative operative Leonard Leo, who served as Donald Trump's judicial advisor. Andrew relentlessly pursues hypocrisy and corruption among all of the powers that be, wherever they fall on the political spectrum, left, right, or center. Andrew Perez, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
On July 31st, The Lever published an article you co-wrote with reporter Julia Rock called Obama's Greenwash. Before we get into the substance of the article, tell us, please, what was it that first sparked your interest in digging into the research about former President Obama's climate track record?
Sure. First we saw that President Obama had recently given an interview where he was talking about how he and his daughter have had these conversations about climate change, where she's, you know, noting that her friends feel like there's no way that we're going to solve the climate crisis. And feeling pretty despondent about it. And he then sort of talks about how, you know, if we work really hard, we may be able to cap global temperature increases to, you know, 2.5 degrees Celsius instead of 3, or 3 degrees instead of 3.5, and how that might mean, you know, the difference between whether Bangladesh is underwater or whether 100 million people have to migrate. I also remembered watching Obama's Netflix documentary about national parks around the world, where he only kind of talks for a brief moment about how we can still fight climate change. I and my colleagues just found, the recent comments just kind of jarring in light of President Obama's record in office, where, you know, his administration chose, instead of prioritizing climate policy first and foremost, to expand fossil fuel production. And you know, I think his recent comments show, you know, the extent to which he knew better.
Andrew, for context, can you explain just who are the corporate power players who are exerting pressure on lawmakers to keep them from taking other steps towards combating climate change?
Sure. I think there are many. There's big oil and gas companies. There's probably some utility firms who have an interest here. There are big corporate lobbying groups that represent oil and gas companies, as well as, you know, just industry generally. Then there are industry-funded think tanks. There are, you know, corrupt politicians in Washington and all over. And then I think there are, you know, center-left politicians and, you know, allied organizations who buy and share the industry line too. You know, that like we can have this, you know, all of the above energy strategy where we can still keep developing fossil fuels and while we work to solve the climate crisis too. But, you know, it's definitely just a problem towards meeting those goals. You know, they think that people don't want disruption, but I think they play just as much of a role as, you know, as the industry and, you know, corrupt politicians in maintaining the status quo.
Andrew Perez, in your article, Obama's Greenwash, you spotlight David Axelrod's influence on the Obama administration. Can you tell us more about who David Axelrod is and how he has influenced Barack Obama in what he's doing today?
Sure. So David Axelrod was a top advisor and strategist for Obama's 2008 campaign, and then was high up in his White House during Obama's first term. You know, now he's sort of like a commentator. He's on CNN a lot. He also ran, until recently, the University of Chicago's Institute of Politics. You know, recently we saw Axelrod tweeting, and this definitely motivated us as well. He was tweeting about how, you know, we were warned for decades that and the world shrugged, skeptics dismissed science, and now the effects of climate change are inescapably clear. You know, that came only a few weeks after Axelrod said that it was okay and acceptable that Democrats gave Joe Manchin in their debt ceiling deal an effort to fast-track the Mountain Valley Pipeline, expedite all of its permits, this really controversial fracked gas pipeline from West Virginia through Virginia through pretty dangerous terrain. It's estimated that pipeline project is going to cause emissions equivalent to 26 new coal-fired power plants. When Obama was president, Axelrod was also believed to have helped steer the administration away from climate action and helped keep it from being a topic of messaging and focus in Obama's 2012 reelection campaign.
Andrew Perez, in your article Obama's Greenwash, which appeared in The Lever on July 31st, you track both the words and the actions of Barack Obama during his presidency as they relate to combating climate change. Please tell us about some of these forks in the road, which then-President Obama could have but chose not to be more proactive.
Sure. There were plenty of warnings during Barack Obama's presidency about how we are heading towards significant planetary warming and how that's going to be devastating. He spoke about how there was no greater threat than climate change. But he also pushed an all-of-the-above energy strategy that included expanded fossil fuel production. And he did so, as we pointed out in this piece, in front of oil fields in a campaign stop. Obama oversaw a giant fracking boom, and there was a lot of, there was some pushback from local communities during that time about the local effects of fracking. And Obama also signed legislation lifting the 40-year ban on crude oil exports. In the 5 years after that, we saw a giant 750% increase in fossil fuel exports. And so, while the U.S. made some commitments to lower emissions broadly, we kept expanding fossil fuel production, and the trajectory did not really change.
If former President Obama and his strategist, David Axelrod, are truly committed to changing the course of history and slowing the demise of humankind, what could they be doing right now?
Yeah, I think instead of tweeting and doing interviews, talking about how we can still limit the worst effects of climate change, I think they can speak out about what's happening on a policy level, and also admit where they fell short when they were in office. I think Obama and Axelrod can be more honest about how they, like Joe Biden, pursued an all of the above energy strategy that really just encouraged more fossil fuel development. Admit that was a mistake and call on Joe Biden and Democrats to stop pursuing that very strategy right now.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with Attorney Maria Hall. We're broadcasting Law and Disorder, an interview with Andrew Perez on the climate change catastrophe. So that listeners don't get the impression that you're picking on Democrats, let's turn our attention to the GOP candidates. I assume that they're subject to pressures and corporate influence that you discussed earlier. Could you please talk about how the GOP presidential hopefuls have been handling the climate crisis issue?
Yeah. Well, the Republican presidential candidates are really not talking about climate change. PBS did a story about this a few days ago. The candidates are just actively ignoring the topic. To the extent they're talking about, this at all, it's sort of in the fine print. They they want to expand fossil fuel production. They want to make sure investment firms do not prioritize environmental considerations in their investment decisions. Ron DeSantis, in particular, wants to make people less likely to buy electric vehicles. You know, I think Republicans...
Well, speaking of Ron DeSantis, you published another article in The Lever on August 8th called Ron DeSantis, Fake Populist. Can you summarize some of the key points in this article?
Sure. Well, so Ron DeSantis, the Florida governor, recently released an economic agenda that he said would, quote, declare our economic independence from the failed elites and policies that have harmed this nation's middle class. But, you know, when you get down to it, few, if any, of the items in his agenda would actually threaten the economic power that, you know, either the ultra wealthy or large corporations have over Americans' lives. You know, and some of the items in there would just actively boost corporate profits. But, you know, one thing that's been really amazing to see is DeSantis keeps in this sort of faux populist pitch. You know, he keeps hitting at this war on woke investing, trying to make it a populist issue. You know, this idea that investment firms should avoid thinking about any kind of ESG considerations, like environmental, social, governance considerations, in their investment decisions, and should, you know, that these companies should instead fully prioritize the short-term financial interests of their wealthy shareholders. You know, at its core, this is an anti-populist pitch, right? This is the idea that businesses should prioritize immediate value for their shareholders over their workers or the broader population in an era of intensifying climate change and massive inequality. So no, that it is not a populist idea. It is anti-populist.
This is a looming catastrophe. And what is so disturbing is what you've just discussed. But if you were the president, hypothetically, what would you be doing? What would you be saying? What would you be doing to mobilize people?
Yeah, well, you know, there's been talk of that President Biden should declare a climate emergency. And he's been reluctant to do so, you know, despite recently calling climate change an existential threat. You know, we've seen that Biden is accelerating drilling faster than Donald Trump. And he also backed, you know, a recent Supreme Court ruling helping advance the Mountain Valley pipeline. You know, I think it's important to not just hit at this issue rhetorically. It's you know, should really be a priority. Like what we've seen this summer has been pretty insane, right? Like just the weather all around the globe. You know, we're seeing, you know, giant wildfires and just incredibly high temperatures and including, you know, surface water temperatures in the ocean. We're seeing, you know, the intensifying effects of climate change now that we, you know, maybe people didn't expect to see for years or decades. We're starting to see it now. And, you know, it's good for Biden to be calling climate change an existential threat, but it is true. And he should be acting accordingly. The government shouldn't be just Democrats in government should not be making, you know, deals with Joe Manchin to expand fossil fuel production. You know, fine, like they're lucky to have a slim majority, but that doesn't mean we need to be moving faster towards disaster. It does not, like, there is no organizational or moral imperative to be expanding fossil fuel production, to be giving a coal baron senator, you know, de facto veto power over every decision. Like, instead of just accepting that reality, you know, accepting that as reality, I think they should be pushing back. I think they should honestly just be working and treating climate change like the really, really significant issue that it is. Not just some, you know, not just treating it like it's something you hit at every now and then in a speech to make liberals happy. I think they have to be treating it like it's an issue they take seriously.
It's really alarming. When I read that the Mountain Valley Pipeline that you talked about that goes between Virginia and West Virginia is going to be the equivalent of 27 coal-fired power plants, and they let that go by. It's plenty scary.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and so they, you know, this might be somewhat interesting to your listeners. the way they're seeking to expedite this project is by limiting judicial review. Basically, they're seeking to close out existing litigation that's been holding up this pipeline for years now. You know, this pipeline has been sitting. The project has been stalled for many years due to local environmental challenges. And you know, the idea here is that the Supreme Court and other courts should not be able to review the case anymore. You know, it's funny. It's something that progressives have called on Democrats to use similar provisions like these provisions shutting down judicial review. And it's something you saw in Democrats' law that's allowing Medicare to negotiate a handful of drug prices. They included a provision in that barring judicial review. So, you know, that's an area like, ooh, maybe this is good. Maybe this is a good idea. But, you know, it was then quickly used in the complete opposite direction, right? To like shut down, you know, local communities who are concerned about the local environmental impact of the Mountain Valley Pipeline. You know, it's going to run through some really steep terrain that's susceptible to landslides through the Appalachian Mountains. You know, you're talking about areas, you know, Appalachia has been decimated over the years by, you know, fossil fuel production. And so to be running this pipeline through this dangerous terrain is pretty nuts. And it's completely fair that the local communities don't want it.
And you brought up another point about judicial review, and I know you've done plenty of writing about our highest court, the U.S. Supreme Court, because that is supposed to be a check and balance situation here. But you've written also about when corruption reaches that level. Can you comment on that subject about maybe some of your more recent articles about U.S. Supreme Court justices?
Yeah. Well, you know, today we just saw another, you know, pretty stellar report from ProPublica about the way that Justice Clarence Thomas has been accepting, you know, free luxury trips, plane flights, helicopter rides. That's just in addition to the general vacations from a rotating cast of billionaire benefactors. These stories are altogether really, you know, pretty frightening. They paint a picture of a Supreme Court that is lawless while setting law for everyone in this country. One of the stories we recently wrote about was, you know, Justice Samuel Alito recently came out in the Wall Street Journal arguing that Congress cannot impose regulations on the Supreme Court, effectively that are arguing that Congress cannot attempt to impose ethics standards on the Supreme Court, despite them having, you know, done it more than several times. And as Alito and seven of his colleagues on the Supreme Court, you know, when they were up for confirmation, they all, you know, actually volunteered that they planned to follow and would adhere to, you know, a slate of ethics regulations imposed on them by Congress, you know, regulations regarding the acceptance of gifts and disclosure of gifts, regulations on limiting their outside employment income, and, you know, as well as regulations just mandating recusal in specific circumstances. All the eight of the Supreme Court justices, including Sam Alito, have, you know, pledged to follow these laws. And now you have Sam Alito telling, you know, the Wall Street Journal that maybe actually Congress can't regulate the Supreme Court at all. And saying his colleagues agree with him, despite, again, seven of his colleagues volunteering that they plan to follow these ethics laws. You know, he's not the first to make, you know, this point, honestly, because Chief Justice John Roberts in 2011 wrote a memo questioning whether Congress can really impose ethical standards on the court, saying, you know, we follow these voluntarily, but it's never been tested whether Congress can impose ethical standards on the Supreme Court. you know, and these are people in lifetime appointments who are ruling on issues that affect everyone, right? They are setting law in this country. And the idea that they should, you know, be unaccountable at all is, should be pretty frightening to people.
Where can listeners learn more about you and read your articles?
I write for The Lever. Our website is levernews.com. And you can find me on Twitter at Andrew Perez DC.
Andrew, it's been a pleasure for Maria and I to be able to interview you today. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.